It's Wednesday, April 3rd. Israel said it wanted aid workers in Gaza, then it killed them. We start here. A convoy of people delivering food is hit by an Israeli airstrike.
And here you have Netanyahu saying, yes, we're terribly sorry this happened, but this is war and mistakes happen.
Why, this could be a turning point for families in Gaza and for lawmakers in the U.S. Florida was already going to be a battleground state. Well, now the stakes are even higher.
We definitely see Florida in play.
What happens when Joe Biden, Donald Trump, and abortion are all on the ballot? And driving a bus can be dangerous, but it shouldn't be deadly.
We've had drivers where machetes have been pulled. Urine has been thrown on them.
Now, cities are examining how to stop rising crime on mass transit. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Before the war in Gaza began, Israeli Defense Forces estimated there were about 30,000 Hamas fighters there in Gaza. This terror group, they said, had to be wiped out, all 30,000. The thing is, there are more than 2 million civilians in Gaza. So the question was always going to be, how will these 2 million innocent lives fit into Israel's military plans? Are they seen as a priority or as expendable? Over the last few months, critics of Israel would say that question has a clear, disturbing answer. It started with airstrikes, of course, attacks that took out militants and civilians alike, then a ground incursion that often put women and children in the path of gunfire. But in recent weeks, the real test of Israel's priorities has been the number of people starving in the streets. The hunger has become so widespread that the United Nations now predicts a straight-up famine in the Gaza Strip. It's not that there isn't enough food nearby to feed these people, it's that it can't get in, it can't move. Access to Gaza is still largely controlled by Israel.
The constraints upon the importation of aid by the Israelis is strangling the aid flow.
More than any other issue, this is the one that has infuriated the U.S. government. The U.S. lobbied to have nonprofits get into Gaza, including the World Central Kitchen, which was founded by an American chef, Jose Andres. Well, yesterday we learned that a convoy of World Central Kitchen vehicles had been attacked, hit by Israel in an airstrike. Unarmed volunteers are dead, and the immediate response from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was, quote, "It happens in war." Let's start the day with ABC's chief national correspondent, Matt Gutman. Matt, what actually happened here? Set the scene for me.
So the big scene, Brad, is that both Israel and the international organizations have been able to agree on one thing. The distribution of aid in the Gaza Strip is not working.
Children are dying of malnutrition. They are dying of dehydration. The only way is to get that aid through on the roads. And it exists. The aid's a few miles from here.
Aid groups are unable to get it where it needs to go. Israel is now very much in favor of trying to get that aid to the people who need it. But they're saying, hey, the UN hasn't delivered any aid, specifically food, from the south of the Gaza Strip to the north of the Gaza Strip in months now. And now we understand why.
It's about a 200-ton barge, which we're loading up right now, with all kinds of different food aid. Once this gets there, it'll be offloaded by a crane, it'll be put on trucks, and we'll be taking that into northern Gaza.
What they had thought that they found in World Central Kitchen is this bootstraps organization that was able to drop in to the Gaza Strip, full of violence and airstrikes and militia, and somehow set up a logistical operation in which they could do what the UN wasn't able to do, delivering dozens of dozens of trucks of aid from the south to the north, where 300,000 people are facing famine and starvation. They were able to build, using local contractors, this pier right off the coast. Israel helped facilitate it. Israel thinks, oh, wow, World Central Kitchen is the answer we've been looking for. We can work with these guys. Behind the scenes, in public, they were hugely in favor and supportive of everybody they've been working with World Central Kitchen, saying, these people are legit. They're getting the job done. We see a future with them. And then this happens.
Seven aid workers, including a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen, killed while delivering desperately needed aid in northern Gaza.
They kill seven unarmed World Central Kitchen workers, some of the most veteran operators that this NGO has. People who've survived Haiti and Ukraine are now blown up in Gaza. Not only were these vehicles clearly marked as World Central Kitchen, Israel had coordinated their transit from the pier to the distribution site and then out.
Wow.
They sit together in the same meetings. They're constantly in communication. So how this happened, Israel still hasn't exactly said. There is some word that maybe they're blaming some of the soldiers on the ground who say that World Central Kitchen and other humanitarian organizations didn't properly coordinate with them. We don't yet know.
We will get to the bottom of this and we will share our findings transparently.
Israel says it's launching a full-scale investigation, and I can tell you from speaking to people who are directly involved, they are in shock. They know that this is a monstrous disaster. They don't know how to fix it just yet, but I do think that heads might roll and this might make a difference. The question is it too late?
Well, but then, I mean, describe how that stacks up compared to the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, his remarks, and I guess the U.S. response to all this.
The U.S. has roundly condemned this. So has Britain. So was the home country of all of the international aid workers who were killed, calling it atrocious, saying this cannot be, saying this is unacceptable. And here you have Netanyahu saying, yes, we're terribly sorry this happened, but this is war and mistakes happen. I don't think that that's the kind of apology that the White House has wanted to hear. I don't think it's something that will provide any solace to people like Chef Jose Andres and the team and the families. And it's probably just going to make matters worse. And remember, U.S. and Israel relations are probably at their lowest that they've been, I would say, in 30 years.
Well, this is the thing, Matt, because if you want to be cynical, like there are critics of Israel who said this starts to not just look like Israel doesn't care about getting food in. It starts to look like they want civilians to starve. No one from the official realm is saying that. But I guess the reason that comes up is because of what you just described of how kind of preventable this was. You've talked about how this is like a tale of two strikes, this thing that happened in Gaza versus also what we just saw a few days ago, this remarkably high level strike elsewhere in the Middle East.
I think you'd be right to think that. There is obviously nuance here, right? On the one hand, on that same day, in that morning, Israel killed seven top Iranian officials in Damascus, a city that is bristling with surface-to-air missiles. They launched this airstrike. There are no other people killed except for the people they wanted dead, who are considered among the most protected and secured people in the entire Middle East. So this attack in Damascus against the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, like number two, took likely months to plan, weeks to execute, and finally pull the trigger on. So you're saying, how can a country that launches that kind of sophisticated strike make such a boneheaded and obvious mistake in killing seven unarmed aid workers who are delivering food with whom you've been coordinating or in contact with?
Right.
It's mind-boggling. And I think the answer is that there are two separate sets of teams that work here. The one that is working on the Damascus strike is, first of all, veteran soldiers and reservists who've been doing this kind of work for years. And they've been thinking about this project likely for months. A military analyst who used to be involved in this planning tells me that the people who are in charge of the airstrike that killed the seven aid workers from World Central Kitchen are probably young soldiers who are tired, who've been doing this, and probably don't have the best of discipline. Something obviously went terribly awry here. So you can think of this as like the Major League team does the Damascus strike, and then you have the Bush League team that's working in Gaza and that pulls the trigger on something that might or might not be dangerous.
This incident is yet a further reminder that Israel needs to do much more to protect humanitarian personnel and facilities in Gaza.
There's a bigger question here too, Brad. If the UN has been saying it's not safe enough to deliver aid around Gaza and it's unable to distribute, and now the one operator that Israel was hoping would be its major contractor to get aid from, let's say, Cyprus, where they're building huge warehouses to deliver aid via sea to the Gaza Strip and via truck on land routes, if they don't exist and the UN is unwilling to do it, and Israel is showing that it's way too dangerous to deliver the aid, what does that mean for the 1.7 million Palestinians who are suffering catastrophic hunger? How are they going to get food right now? And we don't have an answer to that.
Well, and the country of Cyprus said it had 240 tons of food on the way. Its ships are now turning around. Several world leaders put out statements condemning this. Countries who are often supportive of Israel, including President Biden, put out a statement last night saying, "This is not an isolated incident, that Israel has not done enough to protect civilians or aid workers." He used the words outraged and heartbroken to describe all this. Matt Gutman, big moment here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brett.
Next up on Start Here, did a court order on abortion just give Biden a shot at winning Florida? We're back in a bit. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. You might have heard a couple nights ago, the Florida State Supreme Court made a ruling upholding the state's controversial ban on what amounts to the vast majority of abortions. But as part of that ruling, they also cleared the way for this to go straight to voters. And yesterday, we saw it dawn on much of the political world how this could impact Election Day. ABC's Jay O'Brien covers Capitol Hill. He's also spent years covering the Florida State House, so he knows the dynamics here. Jay, first of all, can you just walk me through this ruling?
Yeah, it's complex. There's a couple things to keep in mind. One, Florida's constitution has in it an enshrined right to privacy. Keep that in mind for a second. And also, there have been two abortion bans passed in Florida in recent years. So this case on paper refers to a 15-week abortion ban that was passed in 2022, signed into law by Governor Ron DeSantis. And opponents of that law sued because they said we have this privacy provision in the state constitution that invalidates this law in theory. That's the legal argument that was made. Mm. Now, while that case plays out, the Florida legislature passes another law, a 6-week abortion ban. They actually passed this after Roe v. Wade is overturned, and they time this law to take effect if there is a legal conclusion with the 15-week ban. So the state Supreme Court takes up this case over the 15-week ban, and they say, no, this right to privacy that was enshrined in the state constitution does not invalidate this law.
Oh.
They say that because in their legal opinion, that when this right to privacy was created by the state referendum in the 80s, that the voters in Florida did not have in mind that it would cover abortion rights. The legal argument against that was the exact opposite, that a right to privacy is always considered as covering abortion rights. Yeah.
Right. And in the 70s, that's what everyone's saying, is the right to privacy is abortion rights. They're one of the same.
Right. So there's a lot of legal consternation about this decision by the Florida Supreme Court, but that's the decision that they made. And by upholding this 15-week ban and saying that a right to privacy in the state constitution doesn't strike that down, they clear the path for this 6-week ban to take effect because it neutralizes any challenge against it. And here's the thing about a 6-week ban, Brad. is doctors tell us it could have serious effects.
The six-week ban is basically a complete ban, and that represents a big problem because I would say that more than half of the patients do not have a clue that they're pregnant by 6 weeks.
It also has an effect on the fact that Florida for years has been considered a kind of refuge for women seeking abortion in the South. Typically, abortion rights was an issue that a lot of Floridians agreed on. And only in recent years in the administration of Ron DeSantis has Florida started to roll out these pretty significant abortion bans, 15 weeks and then 6 weeks.
A baby that has a detectable heartbeat, you know, that is a life. And we're better off when everybody counts.
So all of that plays out while at the same time, the state Supreme Court issues a separate decision that is deeply related to this. They say that this ongoing ballot measure giving voters the chance to enshrine abortion rights into the state constitution, that can still go forward. And so that is now going to be on the ballot in November.
Wow. And so then to know that abortion is on the ballot, like yes or no, we've seen how much that has ignited voters across the country, often with people being on the side of abortion rights. Now you have that vote taking place the same day as the presidential contest. Like, what could that mean?
Yeah, I've spent the last few days calling Democrats in Florida who frankly, Brad, are more optimistic than I've heard them in a really, really long time. Mm. Because while a lot of them don't agree with the Supreme Court's first decision about the 6 week ban, they believe that this issue, the ballot measure, will galvanize a lot of their voters, particularly suburban women who in Florida may not have had much of a reason to go to the polls because Florida used to be a purple swing state, but is now a deeply red state.
This is not a partisan issue. It's a healthcare issue. So we want folks to know what's at stake. A yes vote on four is a vote to stop the 6 week abortion ban, but it's also a vote to remove politicians from this process more broadly.
So Florida Democrats are feeling energized by the fact that they can say to voters, abortion is on the ballot in Florida. And frankly, they have seen other states make that case to voters, and that has been successful.
We definitely see Florida in play.
Nationally, you're seeing a lot of Democrats get excited about the possibility that this really gets out the vote. Hakeem Jeffries, the House Minority Leader, the top Democrat in that chamber, is saying that this is something he believes could be a winning issue for Democrats in November.
Florida is now ground zero in the fight to protect the woman's freedom to make her own reproductive health care decisions. And as House Democrats, we are here to make clear that we stand with you.
The jury's out on if that's actually true, but nonetheless, that's the argument they're making in the wake of this ruling.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that, I mean, it stands to reason, I guess, if more Democrats show up, then you could turn the state purple or even blue again. How likely is that, though?
I mean, look, state Republicans will tell you that, A, they believe that while this might have an impact, it's not going to have as big of an impact at the polls as Democrats believe. Mm-hmm. They've pointed to some previous ballot measures in Florida, felon voting rights, for instance, and the minimum wage that had a lot of Democratic support, but didn't necessarily turn out Democrats to the polls in the way that maybe state Democrats had thought they would. But abortion is a much more galvanizing issue than those two issues are. The other thing, too, is that the state Democratic Party in Florida over the last few years has really withered. Ron DeSantis has cemented his control over that state. He won re-election by a massive margin. He flipped areas of Miami-Dade County that are typically Democratic heavy that are now deeply Republican because of Ron DeSantis. He's done a lot in that state for Republicans. Republicans now outnumber registered Democrats in the state of Florida. A lot of that is thanks to Ron DeSantis and his control over the state Republican Party. So state Republicans say, because we've done all that, we are going to be able to outpace Democrats here, that Florida is not, as the Biden campaign would say, quote unquote, in play. But nonetheless, we have never seen an issue like abortion rights play out in the way it is playing out in a presidential election year. So in many ways, Brad, all bets are kind of off.
Yeah, and of course, and political analysts will also tell you, like, people also have the ability to show up and vote for one issue, but then turn around and vote for a different candidate. So you can imagine people showing up excited about abortion, but then not necessarily ticking the box for Joe Biden. All right, Jay O'Brien there in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
It's very weird living in a big city like New York right now, because while violence on city subways has become this national talking point, depending on who you talk to in New York, residents might have vastly different perceptions on what it is like to ride. And it's not just New York either. So how do you judge violence around you? How do you truly tell if the place you live is out of control? Well, recently, ABC's investigative unit dug into the data to get a sense of violence on mass transit and what cities are doing about it. Let's bring in ABC senior investigative correspondent Aaron Katursky. Aaron, how bad is this problem when you look around the country right now?
The numbers ebb and flow, Brad, and generally, the post-pandemic surge in violent crime around the country has been subsiding. But in mass transit systems around the country, there have been some rather high-profile instances that make riders feel uneasy.
I gotta be careful. Anybody could get pushed, and somebody got pushed tonight.
But I take this line, and it's just tragic.
Here in New York City, for example, we've had several people who've been pushed on the tracks or a subway conductor attacked with a bottle.
The 38-year-old woman was in her train cabin when the bottle hit her.
In Los Angeles, a Metro bus driver was carjacked by an armed suspect with a BB gun.
Reached into his waistband as if he had a gun and stated to the bus driver to just drive.
Guy grabbed the steering wheel, hit a bunch of parked cars before crashing and injuring the driver.
That driver then plowed into the Ritz-Carlton.
In Philadelphia, there were shootings involving SEPTA riders over 4 days.
In the latest incident, a 37-year-old was killed while riding a SEPTA bus in South Philadelphia.
The city leadership is trying to bulk up security. And these kinds of incidents only fuel a perception, and in some cases it's reality, that crime on mass transit systems that millions of Americans depend on every day is out of control.
Well, and that's kind of what I appreciate about the reporting from you and the investigative team here is it is easy to have the perception, right? And yet there have all, you know, there's always been violence on, you know, in urban areas where people are crowded together. So the reality, you say, I mean, what do the numbers tell you? Because you look specifically at Los Angeles and the LA Metro, right?
We did. And in Los Angeles, the problem is rather pronounced. Since 2020, we've had a look at some of the statistics from the LAPD, and they show that the average monthly crimes reported on the LA MTA, they've been increasing about 65%. Mm-hmm. And just in the last year, between March of last year and February of this year, where we have the most recent statistics, average monthly violent crimes on MTA properties rose more than 15%.
Wow.
So it is a problem, and it's one that Los Angeles is particularly attuned to because they're just a few years away from hosting the Olympic Games, and mass transit's going to be key.
We've had drivers where machetes have been pulled, urine has been thrown on them, feces, you name it, whatever they can get their hands on.
We spoke to a woman named Christine Ivey. She spent about three decades operating buses throughout Southern California.
We have nothing that really protects us from our passengers when we get an angry passenger on our bus that doesn't want to adhere to, you know, the policies, or for whatever reason they were angry before they got on the bus.
And what she says, Brad, is that bus drivers like her have many of the same concerns as the passengers.
If you factor in drivers being assaulted, it's a career that a lot of people would not want to do based on that fact. So it kind of has a trickle-down effect.
Yeah, so, I mean, what do you do about it?
The LA Metro says it has a plan to deal with this, and they're trying to surge not only law enforcement officers and transit security officers into the system, they're trying something else, and that is unarmed, care-based personnel. People who can give you anything from directions or perhaps direct you to available resources if you're experiencing homelessness.
So if you don't provide a safe environment for them to commute in, you're putting the public in stressful situations.
One way the LA Metro tried to address the problem was by hiring a former FBI agent and safety specialist, a guy by the name of Andrew Black.
We have robberies, open drug use, drug sales, prostitution.
He was the deputy chief of security. The idea was he was going to figure out how to make crime lower on public buses and trains, you know, in the second largest city in America. And he says he wanted to address what he called the rampant crime problem.
Lacking control of who gets onto the system was the root of the majority of the problems.
One of the things that Black wanted to do right away was try to beat fare evasion. And that sounds like a really petty crime, But security experts have told us, Brad, that that's where it starts. And if you can bring petty crime like fare evasion down, that may have a ripple effect at more serious crime. Ultimately, Black says one of his goals was to just hire more officers, and that became a little more complicated.
It was pretty obvious that they had an issue with the way I talked honestly with the bus operators, you know, telling them what it would take to provide meaningful safety and security.
There's politics involved, and he says in a lawsuit that he was fired and he sued for wrongful termination. The LA Metro said in response to this that any claims of retaliation are untrue, and they didn't want to talk about it any further.
Right. The LA Transit Authority also categorically denied his claims. But does that approach work, Aaron? Like, putting more cops in the system reminds me of like the broken window theory that was so popular back in the day. You fix these little quality of life issues, eventually your neighborhood is going to be nice again. But researchers said it didn't actually fix everything.
No, and in fact, a lot of advocacy groups say more cops don't actually solve the problem. Now, in New York City, I'd say an NYPD surge into the subways has reduced crime after a spike at the start of the year. It's been down on the subways in each of the last 2 months, according to Mayor Eric Adams, who's been riding the subways to try and see how things are going.
If they don't feel safe, then we're not accomplishing our task. Stats don't matter if people don't believe they are in a safe environment.
But, you know, more police officers or burdening police officers with chronic problems of mass transit systems, like people living in them because they're experiencing homelessness or people who need, you know, mental health services, that's beyond the purview of the police. And that's what some mass transit systems are now trying to address.
Yeah, and in the meantime, we've talked so much about Los Angeles. The LA Metro says about this combination of law enforcement and unarmed care personnel, quote, "While we know we still have more to do, we also know this approach, combined with adding more frequent service, is working." Aaron Kuchersky, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, imagine something falling off a plane and hitting your house. Now imagine instead of 30,000 feet above you, it's a million feet up. One last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing, it's spring cleaning season. Some of us have been clearing out closets or working on lawns. One guy's making repairs from flying space trash.
A few weeks ago, something from space came crashing through the roof of Alejandro Otero's home in Florida.
That's the voice of ABC's Gina Sinceri, who covers space for us. She says this guy in Florida claims a huge piece of debris just dropped from the sky through the roof of his home. In fact, it was going so fast, it punched through two floors before it finally stopped. Luckily, no one was hurt. Gina says a home security camera caught it entering at 2:30 p.m. Eastern time on March 8th.
Now, this is important because it's a close match for the time that the U.S. Space Command recorded the reentry of a piece of space debris from the International Space Station. At that time, the object was on a path over the Gulf of Mexico, heading toward Southwest Florida.
That's right. According to people who track this stuff, this likely came from the International Space Station orbiting 250 miles above our heads.
Things are jettisoned overboard from the space station. They jettison their trash all the time and their dirty laundry because they don't have washers and dryers on the space station. So it just kind of gets shoved out and usually burns up on reentry. But this did not.
One researcher had published a tweet showing exactly when this pallet of equipment was coming to Earth. Alejandro responded to that tweet with photos saying, "Looks like one of those pieces landed on my house in Naples. Can you please assist with getting NASA to connect with me? I've left messages and emails without a response." Well, Gina has now reached out to NASA on his behalf. Do they pay for your roof or something? What do they do?
Well, I asked NASA if they would pay for the damage to his home, and NASA replied saying they're analyzing the debris to make sure it was theirs and it came from the International Space Station. So they kind of avoided answering that question.
From what outside experts can tell, this appears to be a battery pack that detached itself from a really large pallet of stuff. Usually, astronauts bundle their trash, shove it out the space station, and let gravity slowly do its thing. These batteries were released 3 years ago. They try to time these releases to hit a big ocean, but if something becomes detached, there's no telling where it could end up. Which has Gina worried about her own roof. She lives near the Gulf of Mexico, too.
I think every homeowner should be opening up their homeowner's policy and seeing what the act of God clause in your homeowner's insurance covers if there's a clause for space junk crashing through your roof.
Used to be an act of God would apply to anything in space, like obviously a meteor or whatever. Now there are so many humans and so much man-made stuff out there, it's tough to be like, whoops, this was totally unpreventable. We couldn't have seen this coming. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.